Well, thanks very much, Dursley, for letting me have half an hour of your time. Could you just say for the tape, for Muriel, where we are and what day it is, yourself?
Yes, it's Dursley's dot, Saturday the 5th of September, 12:05 at Ivy Dean, and for a little plug, a Bailey Scott house.
And could you tell me a little bit about your family's background and how it came to be involved in the Manx tourist industry?
Yeah, well, I never met either of my grandparents on my father's side. My grandfather died in 1931, that was the Stott side, and I wasn't born until 1935. My great-grandparents on that side, it was their daughter that married my grandfather. They were called Dursley, and that was Leonard and Ada Dursley, and then there was Robert, I think it was Robert and Ada Stott. I get a bit mixed up with all these folk now, because I didn't know them, sadly. She died a bit younger. And I know that my grandfather must have been, Stott must have been here well before the turn of the century, maybe, I don't know exactly, 1880, 1890. And certainly the Dursleys, who are my great-grandparents, must have been here at least at that time, if not before, because he's obviously a much older man. The Dursleys lived, and came from Dursley of Gloucestershire, strangely enough. They lived in Stathallan Road, where, just for a matter of interest, I was born and my sister, not my brother, he was born in the hospital. My brother lives next door now, the Towers. My father was born in the Laurels, which is next door, on the other end, now belonging to Dandara Man. That was my grandfather's house. And my grandfather's married four times, as indeed was my great-grandfather, so it gets a bit confusing with all the relations. And when I came across all of this, my father was a director of the Palace and Derby Castle Company, and he was vice chairman. And I was going to be, you know, it looked like I was very good nepotism, being very great chance of being on the board. Now, when my grandfather Stott came here, one of the things he did, which involved tourism, he built the Metropole Mansion block. That was presumably was a field or something, or grass. And he built that whole lot. He sold them all except the Metropole, which he couldn't sell. So for 6 years he ran that, you know, and I somewhere had a menu of breakfast at sixpence, but I don't know where it's gone now. And he and my great-grandfather, I'm never quite sure if they were directors of the Palace Company or Derby Castle. I think it was probably the Palace Company, but the museum has all of this.
And I think they merged anyway.
In 1898 they merged. And at that time they would own the Palace Company, the Palace Ballroom and all that sort of stuff. And they raised, from memory, in excess of £200,000 in the form of debenture, preference and odds, equity, which really was an achievement. To have raised something like £200,000 in 1898 was a hell of a lot of money if you take inflation. And today it must be many millions. And admittedly, they raised a great deal in Manchester, I think, where my grandfather came from, Stott, to the Isle of Man. And he was a cotton broker. He also owned the Manchester Carriage Company. And when he saw that the tram cars were coming, he sold that and came over here. I suppose, like a lot of Northerners, they knew the Isle of Man, probably came in holiday. And they were involved with the Palace Company. Well, the two companies were merged. A fellow called Brown, who was the newspaper Brown, was the chairman. There was my grandfather, Leonard Dursley. There was my grandfather, Robert Stott. That's why I'm called Dursley Stott, by the way, obviously. And they were directors of the founding company. Now, early in 1900, I think it was, the Palace Ballroom was burnt down. And you're talking about marketing, or you were a few minutes ago. My grandfather, Stott, I'm told, went around Europe and Britain and found out which was the biggest ballroom. He then came back, and he and the board had this one built 6 foot bigger than any other ballroom and called it the biggest ballroom in Europe, which, of course, it was. I think they were natural marketing men, these people. And, of course, what they saw and had the vision to see, as did a lot of Victorian people who came here of that Victorian era, that the Isle of Man had a great future for tourism, with the folks in England who got 2 weeks holiday in Lancashire in the mills and 2 weeks up in Glasgow, you know, so that, as you know, it was going abroad to the Isle of Man. And those places really, I mean, I don't know if you knew exactly what they had. You probably know all their properties, but the Palace Ballroom, of course, was a vast area. And when I was 11, just at the end of World War II, I can't remember if it was the MGP or the TT, whichever it was, I was a little boy, and my father asked my mother that he wanted to take me down to the Palace Ballroom. And he said, "You'll never see this site again." He was right as well. There were 11,000 people in the ballroom. That was for this first MGP or TT after the war, because you wouldn't be allowed for fire. So that, and of course, as you know, dancing in those days was very popular. In fact, my son has taken a painting, which is by E.C. Quayle, where you can see the people dancing, you know, and he had to dance one way round or another, you know, this slopping about as you do, you know, this weirdo individual dancing. And there was an MC in the middle, and he's been painted out of the painting, which you can see him. And, of course, that was very popular for all the young people. There was the theatre, of course, and there were the grounds, the gardens, and then a hideous bar as you walked up where the cinema is now. Because in those days, the bars here were a bit like the Scottish and Irish bars. They were purely for drinking. As you no doubt know, they're open at 10 in the morning to 11 at night, unlike most other parts of England. In fact, people used to come over on the boat just for the day to drink. They literally did. They used to go on the Peveril, which is now that building opposite the old lemon squeezer, and literally sit there and drink. And how they got back on the boat, I don't know. So I've lived in an era when tourism was a very vast feature, and presumably, I don't know the percentages, but mostly our GNP came from tourism. In fact, you know, it must have been just about everything. And in those days, my grandfather told my father, who told me, that if we had 300,000 visitors to 400,000, we would survive. And this, don't forget, it's only May-September time, if not later. If we had 400 to 500, we were doing well, and 600,000, we were all in clover. And bearing in mind, we had a very short season. One often used to hear people say, what a wonderful way to make a lot of money very quickly. Having had a wife who's people were in boarding houses. I mean, it is true that they did well, but they worked incredibly hard. I mean, and through the winter, a lot of them decorated themselves. My wife's uncle would put paper on the walls. He was magnificent. Wonder, he should have been a school teacher, really. Wonderful man. But they really did work hard. Okay, they had a month off, you know, but they needed it. And he didn't have a night porter. I mean, he would do all that himself, you know. And they really were exhausted at the end of the summer. And I remember they used to bring all the blankets back to my wife's aunt's house to do them through this medium, this German machine, which lasted for 20, 30 years, unlike today. So there was a great deal of that. The boats, of course, of which I'm now director of Steam Pack Company at the moment, you know, for my sins almost, because people keep going on about this new ship. You must have seen photographs or cines, and I have got a cine film of a lot of this stuff, where the boats were just, you know, I mean, you couldn't see the pier for people. For people. And a sort of an aside was that, as the sewers, I suppose, which needed doing years ago, as one used to walk along the promenade, there was quite a strong smell, and for years I was told it was ozone, and it was very good for you, and when I was a little boy, I used to believe all of this sort of stuff. And then, of course, they also had the cinemas, starting with the Royalty, which is now just being knocked down and rebuilt opposite the Steam Packet. That just, as you probably know, used to be a lavatorial white sort of brick building, white tile building.
Your family had that built?
Well, no, I don't know who had it built. It was all part of the Palace and Derby Castle Company, so they must have either owned it or built it. And then there was, if you went into Victoria Street, there was a Regal, of course. These were cinemas. The next one, now the Picture House and the Strand in Strand Street did not belong to them. That belonged to the Strand Company, I think, another name. And those people also owned the cinema in Ramsey, which is now where the tramcar station is. There was a small cinema in Peel, and I think that belonged to Palace and Derby Castle, I can't remember. There was a small cinema in Castletown when I was at school. It used to be this sort of really little flea pit place in Castletown. Very nice little cinema. Only went in it once or twice. There was a cinema at Onken, just below the Bailey Scott Church thing. And in those days it used to be quite sinful, perhaps it's too strong a word, but it was frowned upon if you went to a cinema. I just see who that is. It was frowned upon if you went to the cinema on a Sunday night, you know. But we all used to go. Can you put that off a minute? I'll just see who that is.
He must have been a hell of a good manager to cope with the high season and then...
Well, the manager actually was a man called... Are you on now? Yeah. There was a chap called Fred Barwell who was very much the manager. There were other gentlemen whose names I can't remember, a smaller man who was also did a lot of the managing. So they had the cinemas, which after World War II, of course, were... I mean, I don't know if you have any concept of this. The queues in Victoria Street went from the Regal round in that street down to the Royalty to get into the Regal. I mean, the cinema, as you probably realise, I'm sure you do, was absolutely the form of entertainment in my generation. I mean, there were no TVs and things. You listened to Dick Barton at the end of the war and all that sort of stuff on the radio. But I mean, and I always remember one night going with my father to the Regal and the family. And father, of course, walked straight past the queue. And this chap said, hey, mate, he says, where are you going in? So, are you talking to me? He said, yeah, you. He said, where are you going? Father said, I'm the projectionist. And he said, if I don't get in, none of you will see the film. Oh, sorry about that, Governor. He says, well, off you go. Now, so the cinema was very, very popular. And they used to have A and B films, you know. I don't mean in this, ones were better, they're not sort of this grading of sort of porn or whatever nonsense or sex. But for every A film, you had to take so many B films, like a flip side. So that was always something they had to organise. As I said earlier, Sunday was sort of frowned upon, as it was also frowned upon to go to the theatre a bit. But Father used to take us nearly every Sunday because they had. I can remember seeing Bob Monkhouse when I was 17, and he was as blue then as he can be now, you know, in the theatre because they had no sort of audience. And they used to have some, I don't know if you know, I've got programmes all over, I'll just get you some, but they had very famous artists. And I can remember George Formby, who was then paying 19 and 6 in the pound tax. And when he came, it wasn't worth us paying. It wasn't worth paying, so they gave him expenses. You know, because it literally wasn't. I mean, they had to give him £1,000 to give him what £1,000 sixpences. You know, I mean, the whole thing was ridiculous. And now the problems they had, because I used to hear Father talk about them more, and he never talked about them at all a lot. But I mean, obviously, at the beginning, at the year end, when the season was over, they had managers. Now, one of the impresarios was, Tom Arnold, whose son, funny enough, is now Sir Tom Arnold, who was one of Maggie Thatcher's, he's just retired. And they used to go and see these people and book the shows. So you had the Derby Castle as well, which had, as you probably know, a weekly show, like a musical. And I can remember, as I'm just sort of remembering odd bits, they had Michael Benting, who did an act with the back of a chair, with the piece of the chair. And because there was no TV in those days, this was after World War, you know, sort of 50s or whatever, people didn't understand him in the North. I mean, he actually got what they call the bird, almost, and they had to take him off on the Wednesday night. He didn't last a week. But, of course, with the advent of TV, it became a very... He was a very funny man. But, you know, the difference of humour was much more pronounced because we didn't have this general thing. That was sort of one of the problems, and you had to get somebody else at very short notice. As you walked into the Derby Castle, where the car park is now for the Summerland, there was an arcade with glass on it like that, and you walked under this arcade, and the wall had flowers and shrubs and so on. Then there was a hotel, Derby Castle Hotel. Then you walked up the steps, there was another ballroom, and a bar, presumably, because I was a bit young for them, but there was a bar there somewhere, and a theatre again. Now, I remember Father telling me that when you walked down this arcade, there were penny machines. When the pennies were a decent size, you could see them. And you put these pennies, I don't think you won much, but you put pennies. And do you know that lady, Father told me, or who I think it was a lady, that for the 3 month season that she rented from them, I'm talking in the 50s, maybe 60s, she paid £3,000 a year rent. Now, £3,000 a day is not so much, but then was, but you imagine the number of pennies she had to take to make that worthwhile. And she rented it year after year after year. Now, the Palace and Derby Castle Company also owned the Crescent Cinema, which held, from memory, over 2,000 people. I can remember a premiere there when Anna Neagle came over and her husband Wilcox, or whatever his husband's name was, and that was a big, big night, you know, and everybody was there and all dressed up and we saw all this on, you know, Father was there and so on. Next door was the Pavilion, which was a wooden little theatre, and I went once or twice, I can't remember what I saw. Again, it'd be another type of music hall sort of thing. And of course that was dangerous because it was wood, so eventually they had to knock it down. They also owned Onken Head, you know. Did you know that? Yeah. So, I mean, they had the fun fair, which was a bit sort of doodly. But there's another show up there. And the man who was sort of, that I remember there more than anybody, was Karma the Hypnotist. Because in Britain, I don't think they could do shows. Well, they may have been, but he was very popular. And that was the show. And they always had a show there. So the real difficulty they always had was getting the acts together. Because they couldn't afford necessarily to have the sort of Frank Sinatras of this world. So they either had, in my opinion, I may be wrong here, people on the way up or people on the way down. And they had all, you name them, Tessie O'Shea, Norman Evans, Rubbernut Jackley. Oh, God, I mean, they had them all. Even I probably saw Robbie Wilson there when I was a kid. You know, they had all the famous people. And but the problems came, of course, if somebody was ill or couldn't come or at the last minute let them down. And they also had the big bands. And they had Roy Fox, they had Ronnie Aldridge, which you just died recently, the Squadronaires. And, of course, as I said earlier, dancing was exceedingly popular. The only opposition they had, apart from the cinemas till they acquired those as well, the ones they didn't own, was, of course, the Villa Marina, where Joe Loss, of course, did an absolute wonderful job. My brother used to go out with his daughter, And they did a wonderful, he was magnificent, but he kept wanting more and more of the gate, and I think the corporation got rid of him, which in many ways is a pity, because even if he had more of the gate, I mean, again, he was a wonderful, you know, the band, I can still see him now with his little sort of Roman nose, even as big as mine probably, and his little black jet greased down hair, he could see his hair going up and down the back, but it was a great days. Oh, and the other place, which was marvellous, and probably the best dance floor in the Isle of Man, was the Palais de Danse. Did you know that place? Well, if you know where Maley's is, the chemist, and now belonging to Lloyd's, of course, or Gear, the German people, and then next door there's a sort of Thornton's chockey shop now, I think. Well, next to that has just been knocked down. Well, that was the Palais de Danse. And that was actually a lovely dance hall. It was beautifully lit, I mean, not too dark, not too light. I mean, there was no sort of, you know, and you walked in, and there was a dance floor in the middle. It was beautifully sprung. And then there were pillars down, you know, holding up. And up above there was this, as you used to see in films again, the balcony where people could sit at tables. And I presume you had, there wasn't probably drinks, I suppose. But that was a wonderful dance floor. And there used to be some superb dancing there. They tried over the years to have ice skating in the summer, which is very expensive to have ice places. Rollers, they had just about everything. They were going to go for tenpin bowling alleys in the street where the royalty was, I think. And the problem with that was that in those days it would have cost £10,000 a lane, 10 lanes, obviously 100,000, which was an amount of money they didn't think they could recoup. And it's funny enough that it wasn't until much recently, there was more recently we've ever had the tenpin bowling alley.
How did your dad feel that the Palace Company sort of fitted into the whole sort of big jigsaw puzzle of, you know, getting the Manx tourist industry running? And how did he feel about competitors and the steam packet and the government?
Well, I don't think they had any problem about the steam packet, because the steam packet in those days used to have 9 passenger ships and 3 cargo ships, I think. And, of course, it was a numbers game. I mean, they made their money out of volume, of what I would call volume, you know, numbers. So I don't think there's any problem about the steam packet at all. Then the planes, of course, were not in as great as use as they are today. I think they objected very much to the Villa Marina, simply because it was paid for by the ratepayer. And I think they really felt that was unfair opposition. And I know on a Sunday night they also had the single acts, which were very, very good. And I think that used to, you know, get them annoyed. But I think one has to bear in mind that the Isle of Man is, I don't mean it's nastily, it's obviously insular. People tend to be a little bit parochial. And I've often found that when I used to criticise the boarding houses, for example, for various things frequently, if I spoke to people who were in the boarding house business, they took it that it was a personal insult to them, and it wasn't intended to be. We had an awful lot of boarding houses in those days where people just sort of took as much money as possible. For which you can't in a way blame them. But I mean, the good ones that gave good service got the people back all the time, and some of them still survive today. Where a lot of the others were in it to, you know, turn it over. And I think, you know, that I used to complain about this, and of course people used to think I was talking about them. And a lot of Manx people taking this very, I'm Manx myself, a lot of people taking this very personally here. It's not always meant, it's meant to be constructive, not destructive. But of course the world has expanded. The, you know, steam packets is now a big part of a very big world group. And to go back to these various matters, my father used to tell me that if we wanted to get on in the Isle of Man, my brother and I had to be a director either of the steam packet, the Palace Company, or the Isle of Man Bank. And my brother's chairman, I'm on the steam packet, and we would have been, of course, I certainly would have been on the Palace and Derby Cars Company. And when I was 16, my father was starting to school me by, you know, telling me about these auditions. He used to go to the auditions every winter, you see.
Oh, when were you born, by the way? So we know when you were
35. Right. So I had a bit of King William's at 16. This was, they used to go out after the end of the season through the impresarios I was saying earlier, whoever they employed, like man agents, and they'd go and see all these shows. And I mean, I never actually went. I was just about to go, and I did go actually once. And they used to do the whole thing. I think it was quite a jaunt for these fellas, you know. And I always remember a story totally against myself. I mean, nobody believes it, but I was terribly naive, again, living in this wonderful sheltered island. And when I was 16, my father said to my mother he'd like me to go away to go see some of the shows with him. This was early sort of schooling, I think. And my mother came to me, who was a lovely lady, and she said, "Now, Desi, you must be very careful with these chorus girls, you see." And I didn't know really what she meant. So I said, "What do you mean, Mother?" She said, "Well, they've all got germs, you know." And I thought, just your Jan Nemo, because they all wore these shorts, I thought they all had colds. Oh, yes, and talking about that, they used to have the... So they went away and auditioned for, you know, weeks on end, to a couple of weeks, and stayed in Manchester and all over the place. And that was quite a...
So they would go away, in the sort of... Early spring, later.
Yes, and as soon as these people told them they could come up and see these acts, and they'd be the...
And they would take a hall or something?
Or go to wherever they... There was a hall where the acts came to the hall, and they would sort of sit, and the manager, of course, would go, Mr. Barwell, Fred would go, and they used to decide which ones they would have. I mean, again, it's hard to explain. We're brought up today with companies which have all sorts of regulations which we didn't have in those days. It's good and bad both ways. But I mean, today you meant to have a remuneration committee on the stock exchange, you meant to have an audit committee, you have a CEO, chief executive, used to be called a managing director, you have a chairman who's non-executive, you know, you have all these things laid down. Now, it's in the Isle of Man, it was very much a hands-on job. If you were a director, you directed. And still to this day, people ring me up if they have a problem with anything I'm connected with. They don't think of, it's the way life is. It's not nasty or anything, it's just that, well, I know him. I mean, I'd possibly do it myself, don't I? You know, if you know something. So they didn't have all of this hierarchy or structure, as it's called, you know, charts, organisation stuff.
So what would the sort of management team of the Palace and Derby...
Well, they'd have sent two or three directors, for example, with Mr. Barwell to go and do the auditioning. Some of them wouldn't want to go, so there'd be some that did. And if you read the stuff that you'll find in the museum, you'll find that my grandfather, Stott, seemed to be very instrumental in a lot of these things. You know, just having read through it. And it's quite interesting. I've read the minutes of the AGMs. I meant to do a little booklet on it, actually. I may do one day if I ever live long enough. Oh, and I've got some wonderful photographs that a fellow, ex-policeman, who's one of my shooting men, you know, because I was president of the shooting council, he bought them in an auction, and he said, if you want them, Dursley, you can have them. And he's got these wonderful photographs of the palace, you know, itself, the Derby Castle, and all sorts of things. So I must try and get those, because it would be very interesting.
That would be most helpful.
Yeah, I'll ring him when I come back. If you give me a ring when I come back, I remember. His name's Peter something. Anyway, I'll sort him out.
So how many people overall would the company... So you'd be a young lad in, what, the 60s, 50s and 60s?
Yeah.
How many people would it be employing in the winter? How many in the summer?
Well, of course, the whole of the Isle of Man had seasonal trade. I mean, in fact, I think you'll find that the population of the Isle of Man for most of this century, until recent times, was about 40,000. I looked it up one day, and I found there was 60,000 money. I couldn't really understand this. And what had happened, the census idiots had included all the staff that come over for the summer.
June 1921.
Yeah. You know, so basically it's about 40,000. And I know this is the old sob story, but it is perfectly true. A lot of people get jobs in the summer here through tourism, but couldn't get any work in the winter. So I presume they laid off. You see, obviously the palace would be closed in the winter, the Derby Castle would be closed in the winter. The gaiety might or might not be open. I mean, again, it was seasonal, I think, from memory. They had a thing called Soldiers and Skirts there, you know, and all the actors were men, all dressed up as women. I think a lot of the visitors got a shock there. So they would have reduced, I don't know the numbers, but they must have reduced the staff considerably. Whereas the cinemas would be kept going with the usherettes, the managers and the projectionists. So they would have reduced it enormously in the winter. I mean, I know friends of mine literally couldn't get any work in the winter. I mean, when I came back here in 1959 after university, my father sent me to London in 1960, you know, on the stock exchange, but I didn't have a strict contemporary of mine from King William's living on the Isle of Man. Or if I did, I didn't know them. And it wasn't until about 62 that those who were going to professions like accountants, they were actually back. But they're either older or younger than me, and lawyers. And there wasn't a lot of things to go into, you know. It was because of a family business that I came back. And even after a year of here, I said to Farley, you know, I was offered a partnership in London as a young man, and no way, you know, I think I'll have to go back if things don't improve. And then England started giving away the colonies and the people coming here, and, you know, and it was a different story.
So how did the company change when the sort of Manx tourist industry started to change?
Well, I think then again, people were very slow to accept that tourism was a dying industry. I think it was in the mid-60s, possibly, when it started, much earlier than people really were anticipating. I think maybe the 70s. And you know about that time we brought back the birch, do you? I mean, it was quite alarming here, you know, for a while. I was going out with my wife, and we'd been married 40 years next year. And we met 2 years before that, so we're going back when we were kids. I remember coming out of the Crescent Cinema one night, I must have been in my early 20s, with my wife on a summer's evening, or my girlfriend or fiance, I can't remember it. And there were a host, a group of young men, linked arms, were walking along the pavement, and there's no way you would have dared got in the middle of them. No way. You know, you'd have been hammered. And we had the early louts, I think, to be honest, at that time. And you know what happened with the birch tree? You know why it was brought back?
No, tell me more about that.
Well, what I understand was that there was a policeman off duty on holiday on the promenade in a deck chair or whatever. This is the story I was told. And these kids, the young people, set on some fellow because he'd argued with them. And this policeman went to help them. You know, this man, he got hammered. And that's when we brought the birch back for violence. And contrary to what everybody says, you know, we should bring the birch back. If I remember rightly, it was only used for crimes of violence. You had to be between 16 and 25 or 26. I mean, when you read the papers, you think it was a thing that solved everything. My wife doesn't agree with me, but it was a deterrent. Because people used to come off the boat when we brought the birch back and say, we better be careful here, lads, they've got the birch. I mean, and if that isn't a deterrent, I don't know what is. My wife used to jokingly tell me it was the Manx people who got it most and they were beginning to like it, you know. No, I mean, she's against all types of capital or corporal punishment, and maybe rightly. But it's harder to... I mean, the Isle of Man was absolutely packed. You could hardly walk along the promenade with so many people.
In the 60s.
Yeah, and of course you had all your shanabangs, as we called them, down one side. They did a roaring trade. Now, I'll tell you all about that, if you want that, is a fellow called Michael Marshall. Do you know Michael Marshall? M.L. Marshall. He lives at Annagarth, Clayhead. If you mention my name, he'd tell you... His family were Marshalls of W.H. Shimmin, which that building's just been knocked down recently. Garage. They had a JAG agency, the Sunbeam, all this sort of stuff. My father knew them well. Michael and I have known each other since we were nine. And they were one... And, of course, the Knifetons were all in the coach business. You know, there's all sorts of... Now, that's an interesting side of Manx life.
Is that the Knifeton with Gordon Knifeton?
Yes, their family. Mm-hmm. They you know, now Manx Tour, whatever it's called. But they were all sort of in that business. And that was a very big part because people would go on mystery tours. And people didn't have cars, you see, like today. And they didn't hire cars. I mean, people came... Do you know Cunningham's Undercamp was probably the first of its sort in the world? You know that, don't you? And they used to be in bell tents, I'm told. And they were woken up at 6 or 7 in the morning to do their exercise. I mean, unbelievable stuff. And that funicular railway thing, that was working when my wife was around. Because their boarding houses were down there, you see.
So just going back to the company and what was happening then, so, you know...
Oh, did you tell
me? In the 60s.
I'm running off. Mm-hmm. Well, the numbers were getting fewer, but still sufficient. And I always found sad, was everybody was hoping that next year would be as good as the last time. And, of course, it wasn't. And it started drifting down. And then I think it was in the early, mid-60s... You could check the date. I think Crockford's made an offer for the... was it Crockford? Yes, made an offer for the Palace Company. That was when Sir Dudley Cunliffe-Owen was here. Dennis Poor, who became chairman of Manganese Bronze, he's dead. He was the sort of brains behind it, if not the money. It was Tim Holland, and they took over the company, and they paid, from memory, 56 shillings a share, which my father and I thought was a price we wouldn't see again. So we all... we all sold, and I think about rightly. And then, of course, they then got the casino license, so the thing changed. I think it just almost died a natural death. I know my father used to say they were getting fewer and fewer people to the Gaiety, which used to have a very nice family show, and the result was, of course, you couldn't get better ones. You know, they just weren't making the profits. Oh, now I must remember this. In the Parody Dance, which I told you about, when I came back, it must have been 1959, 1960, 1961. The Palace Company had paid a dividend, again, you could check the facts, something like 20% for years and years and years. And people had come to spend this, you know. Well, I went to my first AGM of the Palace Company around that time. You could tell it because if you look it up, it was the year they passed their dividend. Well, they declared there was no dividend. Now, that would tell you when the turndown, mid-60s, I think, or earlier. That would give you an indication of when things were going wrong. And for the first time in the history, if you go back to the museum, you'll see they passed it, and this was the first one they couldn't pay. They passed it, as we call it. Well, all hell let loose. You know? Talk about some steampacking meetings I've been to. Anyway, when it all finished, I said to my father, that's the best entertainment you put on all soaps. Didn't go down too well at all. So that must have been the turn down. And then, of course, things got tougher and tougher. The cinema was still doing fairly well. But then, of course, TV started to come in. So it was, until very recently, a declining industry. You know yourself that the cinema's coming back in quite a way. It was taking a long time, though. And of course, the shows, I mean, you get so much on TV now. That you see, these people used to go travelling around to Scarborough, to Yarborough, to the Isle of Man, to Blackpool. Nobody'd ever heard them before. You had to physically go and see them so they could do their same act. In fact, Norman Evans, over the garden wall, I'll never forget, he used to stand on this wall as a woman and say, "Hey, hasn't it been a nice day today?" You know, and he used to, with the washing at the back. And but unless you went to see him. So the whole scene changed due to technology, really, I suppose. It sort of altered it. And the profits were getting less and less, you see. So
just say an average sort of working week in the summer, what would you remember your dad doing?
Oh, well, now,
where would you be going?
Well, I can tell you exactly what he did. I mean, A, he was also director of Sefton. And I've been a director of 7 hotels in the Outer Man, the tourist trip. I never learned, really. Anyway, I'm still a director of Sefton, of course. It's my 25th year this year. Father had a great, but he liked to drink, Father. You know, he liked his Worthington beer. Oof. It was too strong for me. And so he always felt it was his duty. On a Monday, Wednesday, and Friday night, he used to visit some of the pubs, the bars, you know, in the places. He used to go and see the shows. He used to check that. I mean, he'd go and stand by the the box when you came in, talk to Mr. Barber, they'd check that nobody was coming through. You see, what they did, they gave a free pass to, I think, every boarding house to go and see the show, say,